This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
It's no secret that the US election over the past year has caused a lot of division, not just in the USA, but around the world, with friends, family and neighbours caught up in a war of words and sometimes becoming enemies as they debate politics at home, at work and on social media. One man who's been deeply disturbed by this division is the respected US Christian author Philip Yancey. He's been especially troubled by the way many Christians have become one-eyed about politics. He says that when we do that, we're actually ignoring the ultimate call of Jesus, which is to love one another. Philip joins me now on the line from Colorado in the USA. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Now, last year, you gave an interview that actually went viral, and you told your interviewer that you were really baffled about the way Christian evangelicals were treating Donald Trump like a hero. Why were you so troubled by their loyalty towards the man who's now the U.S. president?
I was actually in Spain when I gave that interview, and I was speaking at a conference. The person interviewing me said, you know, help me understand this. We in Spain have a history here of the church being too closely tied to the government, and we've been paying the price ever since because the Catholic Church in that case was very closely allied with the Franco government. And then when it lost power, the church lost a lot of prestige and authority and has never really regained it. And I said, I'm as baffled as you are. I can understand why an evangelical might want to vote on certain issues that are important, for example, abortion, very important. However, to hold this man up as a flag bearer, as the hero of evangelicals, when he's a billionaire, became a billionaire from his casinos, he's a philanderer, we know about his treatment with women, he's had three marriages, he's a bully, we've seen that in the debates with Hillary Clinton, to hold him up as a flag bearer, I don't understand it. And there are evangelicals who are saying that he's God's divine appointed servant. I said, I don't know. I thought that interview was going to stay in Spain. Instead, it came out and was leaked to the Huffington Post, an online magazine, did go viral, and my my Facebook site has never recovered. In fact, for 4 days there, I was in the top 10 trending, just ahead of Brad and Angelina's divorce.
Wow, that's a big call. Being up there with Brad and Angelina's divorce means that you had worldwide attention. But the reactions weren't all pretty. What kind of responses were you getting?
Well, I'll tell you, Claire, I learned I was sodomy-loving, baby-killing, pinko communist Muslim sitting on $20 million.
Wow.
Those are the kinds of accusations I got. And what saddened me most, I've got to tell you, at first I thought, oh, no, what have I done? I try to avoid politics, and here I give this interview in Spain. Instead, I'm thrown into the spotlight that I didn't want. But later I realized, okay, this is the platform, and I need to speak to it, and wrote a longer, more thoughtful reflection on the election. It concerns me deeply that, I don't know that phrase you use, one-eyed, that so many American evangelicals are looking with one eye only. And actually, I like that image because we're called to be two eyes. We're called to be what the book of Hebrews calls resident aliens here. You know, we're strangers. We have a commitment to this earth, to the government, and we live in a place, as you do, where religious freedom is guaranteed by the Constitution, by our laws. That's wonderful. But we also have a stronger allegiance to a different kingdom, kingdom of heaven. And Hebrews goes on to talk about the city without foundations. And again and again, as I look back over history, the more the church allies itself with just the earthly kingdom, the more they set themselves up for a terrible failure. And Europe, particularly in the last couple hundred years, has borne the fruit of that because the church and state were wedded for many centuries there. And now many Europeans won't have anything to do with the church because they see it as just one more power structure like the government.
In that article, you talked about how the USA has really lost over the past year some of the values that have held it together. One of those is civility. How was that lost and why is that so important?
It's lost because we've become so divisive. If you've looked at an election map of the United States, as I'm sure you have, you'll see solid blue on the West Coast, solid blue on the northeast coast, these places went Democratic. Everything in the middle, except for five states, so more than 30 states, solid red. And if you look at that, that's not a healthy pattern. That's not a healthy country. It's a divided country. And again, as the culture grows more secular, drifts away from some of its historic Christian roots, there are going to be some issues that Christians care about deeply. I like to quote Martin Luther King. In fact, I think I did in that article. Yes, there are times when we have to fight. But when we fight, we use different weapons. We use the weapons of grace. We can't go around name-calling. We can't go around demeaning our opponents. We can't go around hating. That's not what we're called to do. In fact, Jesus said, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Bless those who persecute you. And you can't do that if you're waving placards calling people hateful names. And what I've seen in my country, when Christians should be bridging the gap, showing how to articulate values and issues that are very important to them, that have a moral base, if we do it by the same tactics that the other side does, we become just like them. There's a phrase from Nietzsche, of all people, who said, beware that in fighting the dragon, you do not become the dragon. And that worries me about Christians. Yes, we should be concerned. But as I go on to say in that article, I talked to a friend from the UK back in John Major's day. He went and visited John Major, and John Major said, you know, I can't figure out these evangelicals. Tell me, are they liberal or are they conservative? And the guy said, they're both. Because on some issues, care for the poor, care for the environment, some of those issues that are very important, sexual equality, some of those things, Christians have a moral basis for those. But on other ones like abortion, like life issues, some of those are traditionally conservative positions, some are traditionally liberal. And we don't make our choice based on what our party decides.
Yep.
We make our choices based on Scripture, and especially what Jesus makes clear about those issues.
You also quoted in your article Shane Claiborne about how mixing Christianity and politics can be like mixing ice cream and horse manure,
right,
which I think is such a clever quote. What is he referring to there?
Well, in his image, his faith, his Christian faith, would be the ice cream, and the politics would be the manure. And what he said was, It doesn't do much for the manure to mix ice cream with it, but it sure spoils the ice cream.
Sure.
And we've seen that. Politics is an adversary sport. You play to win. You play to demean. And boy, did we see that in the last campaign. Maybe it's not like that in Australia. Maybe you have clean, pure politics.
No.
But in our case, the debates were a clear case where, I have to fault Mr. Trump. He interrupted Hillary Clinton more than 100 times. He would say, loser, 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 wrong, you know. And a Christian shouldn't be treating people like that. You have to treat them with respect and care, even when you disagree on really important issues. We're primarily called to shed love and grace abroad. And if you can't articulate your positions with love and grace, then you should keep your mouth shut.
So you're saying that it's actually okay still to stand up for issues that we believe strongly in and to be vocal about those, but to be careful and Christ-like in the way that we do that.
Absolutely. And again, I refer to Martin Luther King, because from the beginning he would say, my goal is not just to win civil rights, not just to end segregation. And I grew up among segregation laws, so I know what they're like. My goal is to create a beloved community, and I have to somehow love the white man. I have to somehow love even the sheriff who's hitting me on the head with the nightstick, even the jailer who's poking me in the cell. And if I can't do that, then I failed my master. I failed Jesus. And because he stuck to that, you know, he didn't fight back. He took it. He took the blows. He did probably the most sweeping social change that our country has ever experienced.
And you're also suggesting that it's not wise to become completely loyal to a particular party. Do you think that the only loyalty we can really have is to Jesus?
The only ultimate loyalty, and we even in the very earliest days of the church in the book of Acts, you would see situations where Peter would say, okay, you say I'm not allowed to talk about Jesus in this case. I must go against your laws. I must speak out. And, of course, that's happening all over the world right now, especially in some countries in the Middle East and in Pakistan, places like that, where Christians are being persecuted just for articulating their faith.
How can Christians bridge the gaps between politically divided groups and parties and even between each other? There are people sitting next to each other in church who believe very, very differently about politics. But something that you said in your article, you said those of us who follow Jesus have some repair work to do in helping to heal our nation. What are some practical ways that we can actually start to bridge that gap?
I'm glad you brought up church, because actually I think that can be an important force. And when I think back to the changes in the civil rights movement, politics, it was very clear, all Southern politicians when I was growing up were racist. They were in favor of segregation, not integration. They opposed all of them. You know, some of them you've heard about, George Wallace and Ross Barnett, people like that. Every Southern senator, every Southern governor, every Southern congressman, they were strongly in favor of segregation. The church, there were many racists in the church. I went to a church like that. Mm. However, the church was unsure about that. And even the Southern Baptists, who take a lot of flack, actually, as early as the 1950s, were passing laws saying, we have to change. We have to be in favor of these integrated laws, because the Bible is clear. There is no Jew nor Greek. You know, there's not a racial divide, and the church is a place where they can all come together. And recent research has shown that it was really that mixed group in the church that kind of seasoned the division that was occurring in the South, which could have broken into an open war when you look back on it. To answer your question, I think small groups of people who get together who are committed, all committed to Jesus, and yet have different views, to articulate them, to look at the Bible directly, to study books which go into those issues. And I've written my own book called Vanishing Grace with a study guide, hoping people can do that. And I've been in some small groups that are using those kinds of curriculums. And it's a great way from the grassroots to start changing first hearts and then minds. Mm. You know, the heart has to change first, really, before most people are open to their mind being changed. And, you know, I also counsel Christians, look, don't put all your eggs in the Republican Party basket. That's a dangerous thing. We should have a strong witness in the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been so rigid on issues like abortion, they won't allow any kind of pro-life spokesman or even input in their various meetings. And that's showing, I mean, I think that kind of intolerance is one reason that they have lost so much ground in the last decade or so. Democrats are wondering, what happened? You know, no one saw this coming. Where did it come from? Well, look at that map again. You know, the red states felt beleaguered. They felt that this kind of coastal political correctness was being forced in them. They weren't ready for all these gender changes and all this intolerance talk that they were getting. And so the Democratic Party, I hope, as I say in the article, is open to some self-reflection and would bring in people. And we do have people. You mentioned Shane Claiborne. Jim Wallace would be another person here in the United States who is strongly committed to Jesus, has a pretty leftist orientation, and can speak to them in a way that can change hearts and hopefully change minds.
Mm. Now, something interesting that you mentioned in your article, you admitted that when you were a young person, you yourself were one of those Southern Christians who was racist.
Right.
You've obviously changed a great deal since then. What was it that changed you?
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Our most famous citizen before Jimmy Carter came along, I suppose, was Martin Luther King. He's right from my hometown.
Right.
And he was not viewed very well in my church. In fact, I almost hate to say the words, but from the pulpit, the pastor would call him Martin Lucifer Kuhn.
Oh, wow.
That's the kind of racist church that I was in.
Wow.
You guys know a little bit about racism in Australia, so you shouldn't be shocked.
Mm.
And I always felt a little uncomfortable. A turning point for me, there were two turning points. One was watching the civil rights movement, which was mostly led by ministers.
Mm.
You know, John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael and, of course, King and Andrew Young, these were all ministers of the Gospels, and they were quoting Jesus up and down. They were having prayer meetings. All of the marches began in churches and moved out from there. Well, you've got to pay attention to that when you are a Christian, as I was, although a one-eyed one at the time, to use your phrase. That was critical. A second thing, a book that just kind of rocked me, was Black Like Me. And it's a true story of a journalist, a white journalist, who took some drugs, some injections, that turned his skin black. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote a book about how here he is, the exact same person. Nothing had changed except his skin color. And suddenly he's not allowed into places. He's spat on. He's pushed off sidewalks. He's treated in the way that we treated people of another color back then in the South. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I realized, you know, it's there's something wrong here. Because here's the same person, but we're treating them the opposite way just because his skin has changed. Maybe the whole thing is just a skin issue, you know. Mm. It's just skin deep. And then gradually, as I went to college and other places, I got to know some African-Americans and Asians, you know, people of other colors. And so many of the stereotypes and myths that I grew up with just collapsed under their own weight because I began to see they weren't true. I had been deceived. I had been lied to. I really believe those racial stereotypes. Racists do. That's why they're racist. Mm. I believe that they were true, and it really took that kind of personal contact, sure, as well as that nagging conscience from my Christian conviction and some of my reading that started pushing me into, you're wrong, man, you've got to change.
Mm. In a lot of the debate and the angry, I guess, exchanges that we see between people on social media and between brothers and sisters and Christians, there seems to be a lot of fear at work, you know, being afraid of what might happen if the other party wins and so on. Mm. What is the antidote to fear, do you think?
There's a very clear statement in the New Testament about that. It says simply, perfect love casts out fear. And as I have studied church history and seen the triumph of the church against overwhelming odds in culture after culture, it's because people are committed to a God that dispels fear. I remember the pictures not that long ago of, I think there were 21 of the Coptic Christians dressed in orange, kneeling at the surf with their hands bound behind them, and one by one they're being beheaded. And when you look at the photos there, I mean, they're almost unbearable to look at. But you look at the two, and the oppressors behind them have these hardened, gritty faces. Mm. I don't see fear on the faces of these Coptic Christians. They were preparing to be welcomed by a God of love. Mm. Perfect love casts out fear. That's one thing that I think Christians can and should spread in a society. Look, okay, there's bad things happening. There's terrorism. There's the fear of the other. There are wars going on. There are all these things. But our ultimate hope is not based on this life even. It's not based on what's going on right now. We truly believe that our God is a redemptive God, and if we stand on his side, that God will give us the resources to cast out fear. And it's done through love. It's not done through giving in to the fear. That only hardens. That only polarizes and divides. And that's why I think we Christians need to concentrate on bridging the gap, not widening the gap.
Mm. One of the issues where fear seems to really drive people's stance is, of course, refugees and immigration. And the fear of, if we let all these people in, what if, you know, terrorists arrive on board? Do you think that a Jesus way of viewing this concern can shift that?
That's a complicated issue. I mean, I think we should vet carefully the people that we allow in, because there are organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS who forthrightly say our goal is to unleash terrorists in parts of the world and create mayhem. Mm. We'll support them, you know. We'll give them manuals that tell them how to do that. So certainly we do have to have checks at the borders. However, it's pretty hard to find a single case of a refugee who came into the United States who was involved in those kind of terrorist acts. There's a lot of fear about it, but when you really look carefully, most of them are homegrown. You know, they're American citizens who were somehow alienated through indoctrination or propaganda or whatever. Europe faces a different problem because there's such a stream of refugees coming in. It's impossible, really, to vet everybody, and, and they're trying to face into that. But yes, we do have to seriously consider who we allow in. On the other hand, I know personally many Christian organizations, one of the best things they do is help bring refugees into the American way of life. You know, so many of these people from Sudan and Syria, they arrive in the United States, their world is shattered, they've left their families, they don't know how an ATM works or, you know, what to buy in the grocery store. And I've seen these organizations, Christian organizations, who assign people to be their mentors, to walk them through. And that's a beautiful way of expressing the love of Christ. There's a lot in the Bible about welcoming the stranger. Remember, Jesus himself was a refugee as a child. He fled to Egypt and then did not find hospitality in Bethlehem and went back to a place in Nazareth where he was welcomed. So I think of the impact of the way Chinese students who came to the United States, many of them did become Christians, and they went back and have really helped the church in China. It's a great, if you're interested in missions, it's a great way to expose people from different cultures to what we really believe. And some of them embrace that and go back as missionaries to their own people.
Yeah, for sure. Just as we wrap up, Philip, I want to ask you one last question, which goes back to something you mentioned early on about the explosion on your Facebook page when you got all kinds of reactions and many of them not nice. Social media, I think, you know, it can bring out the worst in us. As we know, we hide behind our keyboards and say things that we wouldn't say in public necessarily. What would you say to believers, to a Christian audience who, you know, spend a lot of time on social media commenting on stories and issues? How would you want them to act towards one another?
That is a great question, and it's the kind of situation that's just evolving right in front of our eyes, isn't it? What I have found, because I did read all the comments that came in, well over 1,000, and some of the most vociferous ones I would start a dialogue with. Some you could tell right away, you're not going to get anywhere. It's just another chance for them to dump on you. Mm-hmm. But what I prayed and tried very hard not to do was to respond in kind. I would say something like, this hurts, and here's why it hurts, because you really don't understand what I said. This is what I meant, and you may reject that, but wouldn't it be best if we could talk as man to man or man to woman and deal with it in a civil way? Doesn't our country need that? And I hope by just planting those kind of seeds, if every Christian in the world made a commitment, okay, I will always respond in a way that I think would please God on social media, it could change the nature of it. If nothing else, people would look at our responses and say, huh, I like the way they are better than the way I am. You know, I think that's how our faith spreads. It's how this little band of this little sect in the first century against the massive Roman Empire, and then 300 years later, most of the empire is Christian. Why? Because they lived in such a way that the Romans said, I like the way they're living better than the way I live. They care for their sick. They don't just leave their babies out by the side of the road. They invite them in. In fact, they care for my relatives when the plague hits my town and my family fled into the hills. The Christians stayed behind and nursed them. And wherever I go in the world, what are Christians doing? They're digging wells for those who don't have fresh water. They're teaching in mission schools. They're dispensing medicine. You know, who are the first Westerners to die of the Ebola virus? They're Christian missionaries, doctors who are out there at basically minimum wage, if that, often raising their own money and caring for the needy. And the more we do that, the more we act like Jesus. It doesn't always produce the results that we want. Sometimes it stirs up opposition. But over time, people would say, huh, I like the way they're living better than the way I'm living.
Beautiful way to finish, Philip. That's Philip Yancey. He's the author of books like What's So Amazing About Grace and Vanishing Grace. And you can see more of his thinking and writing at philipyancey.com.